It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
One, a snapshot of the midterm elections. Who wins? Who cares? What do they care about? Where do they care about it? A picture, 1 month out from the midterm election. Two, don't be an app like James Corden. Three, a little over 1 month away from not just the midterm election, but from the World Cup. A conversation with Fox Sports soccer analyst Alexi Lalas. It's the Will Kane Podcast on Fox News Podcast. What's up? And welcome to Wednesday. As always, I hope you will download, rate, and review this podcast wherever you get your audio entertainment. Fox News Podcast, Apple, Spotify, or you can watch this podcast on Rumble or YouTube. I fully recognize that soccer is a personal passion that you may not share, that America may not share, but always shared by the world. And in a little over a month, the world will dive into the World Cup. In this podcast today, if you hang out until our third story, you're going to hear, I think, a passionate conversation with Fox Sports soccer analyst Alexi Lalas. I'm going to talk to him and hopefully get you ready in setting your expectations for the United States of America. What players should we watch? What are reasonable expectations for the USA? What are good comps for Spain, for Belgium, for England? Who's the Golden State Warriors? Who's the Alabama Crimson Tide? Who is the Dallas Cowboys? I will use crude American analogies to get us ready for the world's sport, to get us ready for the World Cup.
We'll be right back with more of the Will Kane Podcast.
I'm Dana Perino. This week on Perino on Politics, I'm joined by founder and executive director of Power the Future, Daniel Turner, for a look at how we can advocate for a cleaner earth while strengthening U.S. energy independence. Available now on FoxNewsPodcast.com.
But first, story number one. A snapshot of the midterm elections. According to a new New York Times Siena poll, get ready for a red wave. Get ready for Republicans to take the House and perhaps the Senate and much of the state governorships in the midterm elections. Here is what the latest generic ballot has to say. Republican candidates lead Democratic candidates among likely voters 49% to 45%. What I found interesting in this overarching poll from the New York Times and Siena is to break it down into various demographic categories. How about this? 18 to 29-year-old likely voters go 52% to 40% for Democrats. 30 to 44-year-olds go 50% to 41% for Democrats. Once you get into the 45 to 64 age group, it flips and flips heavily. 38% Democrat, 59% Republican. It's fairly even in the over 65 age bracket. As for the gender divide, 45% of males could go to Democrats as compared to 50%. Females are split evenly between Democrats and Republicans. But what is truly fascinating to me is to bore in, not just on who will win, but why they will win. Who cares and what they care about. If you look at the top issue among voters, you begin to see not just a story of the present, but a story of the future, a future that I fear is one to outlast our midterm election. Top issue among likely voters, the economy, including jobs and the stock market. 26% of likely voters said this is the most important problem facing the country today. Coming in second, inflation, or the cost of living. 18% of likely voters consider that the most important issue facing the country today. This is the number one issue across the age divide. 18 to 29, 30 to 44, 45 to 64, and 65 plus. The economy, far outpaces every other issue that dominates the news. It's the number one issue for males and females to varying degrees. 31% of males to only 21% of females consider the economy the top issue facing the country. If you look into the racial divide, 25% of white voters, 22% of black voters, and 37% of Hispanic voters consider the economy the number one issue. How does it compare to other issues that, again, dominate the news cycle? Well, abortion comes in at a distant third. Abortion is the number one issue for only 5% of likely voters. It over-indexes for young voters, 18 to 29-year-olds. 10% of those voters consider it the number one issue in the country, still ranking it third on their list, a distant third. Immigration ties abortion for the third most important issue facing the country among likely voters at 5%. Crime, 3%. You have to go down pretty far to find some familiar topics in your news cycle. How about these three? If you were to watch MSNBC and to a lesser extent CNN, you would no doubt think that insurrection, January 6th, MAGA Republicans, and Donald Trump are the most serious issue facing the country. In short, the quote-unquote threat to our democracy. What do voters think? 3% of voters consider that the number one issue facing the country today. How about coronavirus? Absolutely dominating the news cycle over the past 3 years. Less than 0.5% of voters consider that the number one issue. And then, how about the war in Ukraine and Russia? 2% of American likely voters consider that their number one issue. All three of those issues, the threat to democracy, coronavirus, the war in Ukraine, all three of those issues come in below crime, immigration, abortion, inflation, the economy. These are what voters consider the most important issues in this country. It's manifested, by the way, in looking at different races across the country. The ones I have my eye on are the following. According to Real Clear Politics polling average, John Fetterman has a 3.4% lead over Dr. Mehmet Oz. That's John Fetterman, Democrat, who suffered a seizure back in April and is fielding questions from reporters as relayed through a computer screen, teleprompter text-generated translations of audible questions so that Fetterman can understand what he is being asked. John Fetterman, who legitimately may not be mentally healthy enough to fulfill the requirements of the job for which he is applying, to fulfill the requirements of being a senator to the United States, according to Real Clear Politics, is outpacing Republican Dr. Mehmet Oz by 3 percentage points. In Georgia, Herschel Walker is trailing Raphael Warnock. Republican Herschel Walker is trailing Democrat Raphael Warnock by the Real Clear Politics average of 2.4 points. Interestingly, Real Clear Politics projects that the Republican, Herschel Walker, and the Republican, Dr. Mehmet Oz, ultimately win those two races. I'm also focused on Arizona, where Blake Masters, Republican, is facing off against Democrat Mark Kelly. Blake Masters is someone that many have described as being on the new right. Trumpism, MAGA, backed by Peter Thiel, a new vision of conservatism, a new vision of America, America first. Trails Mark Kelly, according to the Real Clear Politics average, by 4.5 points. Real Clear projects the Democrat, Mark Kelly, to win that senatorial seat. The other senatorial candidate that fulfills that MAGA, America first, Peter Thiel, Trumpism category is J.D. Vance, Republican in Ohio, facing off against Democrat Tim Ryan. The latest Real Clear Politics average there has Vance up by 2 points and projects a Republican win. Real Clear Politics projects the Republicans take control of the House and the Senate 52-48. And in governorships across this country, 30-20. Those are all good political wins for any self-described conservative. The question is, do wins turn into better politics, better governance? I recently had Kevin McCarthy, who is vying to become the House Majority Leader, should Republicans take over Congress, on Fox and Friends. And I pressed him, what will the federal government do about illegal immigration? If Joe Biden is president of the United States and Republicans control the Senate and the House, what will you do? What can you do to control illegal immigration? I was disappointed to hear Kevin McCarthy reject the idea of embracing the movement to empower states to begin to enforce the border where the federal government will not. This is something we have talked about in the past, declaring an invasion and invoking state power in Texas and in Arizona to do the job that will not be done by the federal government. Carrie Lake, running for governor in Arizona, has said this is a policy that she will pursue, that she endorses. This is a policy that they will use to control the border in Arizona. But Kevin McCarthy rejected that idea, certainly didn't endorse that idea. He said it's his responsibility in the federal government to live up to the requirements of the Constitution and the federal government, and that may be. But when you don't have the power, when Joe Biden has the White House, you have to begin to look for other solutions. You have to begin to share power in order to not win elections, but to improve the lives of American citizens. So as much as I look at these potential midterm election wins for Republicans, I'm looking for the win for the American people. I'm looking for politicians to do their job. I'm looking for politicians to be competent. I'm looking for politicians to be principled, not just politicians who will win. A winning is necessary, but winning is not sufficient. A politician has to live up to the people. We'll see soon if Republicans can live up to the people on the issues that matter to them, on the economy, on inflation, on crime, and on immigration. Or will we simply trade election cycle wins among the major two parties? There's also, by the way, in this New York Times Siena poll, some projection for president. Among those who vote Republican in the primary, they were asked, who would you cast your vote, Donald Trump or Ron DeSantis? 47% of likely voters said Donald Trump. 28% said Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. Even more fascinating, among young voters, 18 to 29, 60% said Donald Trump, compared to 20% who replied Ron DeSantis. This is still Donald Trump's party. This is still Donald Trump's vision of MAGA, of Trumpism, of America First. It will not be another politician's position to lead the Republican Party until they can convince the Republican voter that they're a better candidate than Donald Trump. And that's hard to see, at least in the near future. That's who's projected to win. That's what's important to the American people. That is where the races will be decided. And that is your snapshot, your picture of the 2022 midterm elections. Story number two. Don't be an ass like James Corden. CBS's Late Show host James Corden was apparently banned from a New York City restaurant, fancy brunch locale, Balthazar. Why? Well, here's the report from NBC News. According to Keith McAnally, who is the owner of the famed Soho restaurant, Corden was banned from the restaurant for being, quote, a tiny cretin of a man. He said he 86'd Corden, and it did not make me laugh. According to McAnally, Corden, on two different occasions, berated waitstaff. In late June, Corden accused or showed a apologetic restaurant manager, after finishing his meal, a hair in his food, demanding, get us another round of drinks this second, and also take care of all of our drinks so far. He also threatened to write a nasty review for Balthazar online. Now, many of us have eaten at restaurants, and we found a hair in our food, and we've certainly been unhappy about that. We asked the restaurant to make it right. Maybe we don't demand a round of drinks and all previous round of drinks to be covered by the house. But this isn't the worst example of Corden's behavior. On a separate occasion in October, Corden visited the restaurant with his wife. His wife ordered an egg yolk omelet. Once it arrived, Corden and his wife were upset because they considered or saw some egg whites in their egg yolk omelet. I didn't even know you could order an egg yolk omelet. Is that like bring me the omelet extra unhealthy? Don't get me wrong. I love egg yolks. I love scrambled eggs. I don't do egg white omelets. I don't do egg white scrambled. But I've also never heard it in reverse. Make sure to take all the whites out. James Corden ordered it that way, or rather did his wife. And when it came back with some egg whites, they sent it back. It came back again, and James Corden accused them of once again getting the job wrong, this time because he had home fries instead of salad as the side dish on the egg yolk omelet. Quote, that's when James Corden began yelling like crazy to the server, telling the server, you can't do your job. You can't do your job. Maybe I should go into the kitchen and cook the omelet myself. The server apologized and brought over the floor manager to the table, and the dish was returned again. After that, everything was fine. Corden was given promotional champagne glasses to smooth things out. Apparently, Corden was pleasant to the manager but nasty to the server, adding she was very shaken, but professional that she is, continued to finish her shift. This story is fascinating on many levels. In a previous episode of the Will Cain podcast, I talked with Michael Schellenberger about what it is that is the motivation of those who share a different worldview. Very few people wake up that morning and look in the mirror and say, today I'm going to be the bad guy. But we talked about what it is that leads someone down the path that inevitably we would call evil. And it seems to begin with arrogance, or rather, it may seem to begin with insecurity. Whichever one is the chicken and the other the egg, they unite in some type of unholy alliance into narcissism. Narcissism is arrogance and insecurity married, wedded together. I really do believe, I've thought about that since this conversation, that it is where most human mistakes are made. Somewhere in that nether region between insecurity and arrogance. Once you grant human beings just the semblance, just a bit of power, that's where all of their worst characteristics manifest. You and I have seen it. You've seen it with maybe some of your so-called friends. I've seen it. Maybe you've seen it at a business lunch. The person that you think you know, seriously, that your friend, that your coworker, and the minute they're placed in a position of power over another individual, you see another side. You go to lunch and you see the way they treat a server. And all of a sudden you think, wow, that's who you are? That's that mixture of insecurity and narcissism inside of you that can only really show its ugly head when you are a little bit above another individual? Look, we all get frustrated at work. I know I do. And I'm sure I'm short. I remember my guys back on the Will Cain show telling me that I was moody. I don't think of myself as moody. Right now, my wife is rolling her eyes. But while I might have my moods or I might get frustrated and be short, I'd like to think that I don't treat people as less than the minute that I have a little more than power over them, their lives, or their job. This is an ugly insight into James Corden, just like it's an ugly insight into anybody you get to know and see them and the way they treat waitstaff. But I think it's also insight into how it is we arrive at a position where Dr. Anthony Fauci can't face any vulnerability, any frailty, admission of any wrong. I think it's how we arrive at a place where the World Economic Forum can convince themselves that it's their duty to convince us to eat bugs. I think it's how we arrive at a place where the CDC thinks they can take control of your own health decisions while lying to your face about what's best for you, or worse yet, for your child. This little bit of power combined with that unholy alliance of insecurity and arrogance breeds, or maybe not breeds, but reveals the ugly characteristic that lurks perhaps within us all, that must be reconciled, must be addressed. Narcissism. There's one more element to the story that I find absolutely fascinating. My friend, media critic Steve Krakauer, points this out. James Corden has been granted his privileges to return to Balthazar, free once again to have an egg yolk omelet for brunch. How did he get that privilege restored? By apologizing profusely to the owner, Keith McNally. He didn't apologize to the servers. He didn't go back and make it right with those he berated. He went to ownership. He went to, or played within, the elites and elitism, never having to really address or deal with the people beneath him, the little people that he harmed. Now, there's always a workaround. There's always a loophole. There's always a back door back into Balthazar. Story number three. Let me, if I might, draw you in to soccer. But first, Will's weekly quarterback depth chart. Cowboys took a loss this weekend against the Philadelphia Eagles. The Cooper Rush magic train has come to an end. Hopefully soon, we will now see the return of Dak Prescott and the quieting of those that said, see, Will, told you, Cooper Rush. Soon we will see the return of Dak Prescott. And maybe that will make a change to our top five quarterback rankings on Will's weekly quarterback depth chart. But for now, it's fairly stagnant with the familiar faces. The Allens, the Mahomes, the Herberts, the Jacksons. But not this week. No, this week we're not going to go into Will's weekly quarterback depth chart of top five quarterbacks. This week, curveball in honor of Yu Darvish and the San Diego Padres and the Major League Baseball playoffs. This week, a slider into the worst five quarterbacks in the NFL. Here is Will's weekly quarterback depth chart. Bottom five. At number five, Houston Texans quarterback Davis Mills. Davis Mills has one of the lowest QBRs at 31. One of the lowest completion percentage at 62%. You know what? No, scratch that. I'm not putting Davis Mills in because no one expects that much more from Davis Mills. I mean, if you're a Houston Texans fan, you have hopes, but you don't have expectations. So the fact that Davis Mills finds himself in contention for one of the bottom five quarterbacks in the league should pale in comparison to quarterbacks that we have expectations should be in the top five quarterbacks in the NFL. So let me scratch Davis Mills and put two other quarterbacks' names right there in at number five. How about Los Angeles Rams quarterback Matthew Stafford? And how about Indianapolis Colts quarterback Matt Ryan? Ryan is on the upswing. He showed some promise here and there, but he's been bad. Ryan has been really bad for the Colts this season, taking long sacks, completing short passes. He's made Jonathan Taylor almost worthless in fantasy football. And he's only really been outdone by Super Bowl champion Matt Stafford. My buddy at ESPN, Dan Orlovsky, was making the argument that Stafford is a Hall of Fame quarterback. Stafford leads the league in interceptions so far this season. Every time you look up, he's throwing another one. He throws the ball to two places, Cooper Kupp and the other team. Stafford is really, honestly deserving of contention for one of the bottom five quarterbacks in the NFL this season. Number four, and this quarterback doesn't even need to be penalized for having higher expectations, doesn't even need to be penalized for spending most of his career in contention for a top five quarterback, because he is objectively a bottom five quarterback this season. Denver Broncos quarterback Russell Wilson. Listen, he is towards the bottom in almost every statistical category. Completion percentage, 58%. Downfield passes, throwing them complete at one of the lowest rates in the NFL. Quarterback rating, 83, bottom five. That's quarterback passer rating. Here's QBR, which factors in running, should help Russell Wilson. QBR, 35. It's the fourth worst QBR. Check that, fifth worst QBR in the NFL. Russell Wilson, fourth worst quarterback this season. Third worst quarterback this season, Washington Commanders quarterback Carson Wentz, who's now apparently out for quite some time. His QBR is lower than Russell Wilson. His completion percentage and passer rating higher, but in one of my favorite stats, his average net yards per attempt, That's how far he throws the ball downfield, even attempting to throw the ball downfield and averaged out over the season is at 5 yards per throw. Carson Wentz was awful. Clutch moments, clock winding down on your opponent's 2 yard line. Where does Wentz throw it? To the other team. Wentz is on his third try. And this will be his last offer, his last opportunity for starting quarterback in the NFL. Second worst quarterback in the NFL this season, Chicago Bears quarterback Justin Fields. He's not good. All the same stats, including average net yards per attempt below 4.29, below Carson Wentz. Fields has been so bad that I think Chicago Bears fans have to start asking themselves if they really did draft a franchise quarterback here in his second season, showing not much progress at all. And the worst quarterback in the NFL, like Carson Wentz, now saved more embarrassment by injury, Carolina Panthers quarterback Baker Mayfield, the worst quarterback in the NFL. Passer rating 72, completion percentage 54, average net yards per attempt 4.5, and QBR all the way down at 15. I once thought Baker had it. I advocated for Baker to be the number one overall pick in the NFL draft. I bought a Cleveland Browns Baker Mayfield jersey for Stephen A. Smith. I thought this guy had just the right chip on his shoulder, just the right amount of grit, just the right amount of resilience. Baker Mayfield won't get another opportunity after the Carolina Panthers, and he has been, in this one opportunity, the worst quarterback in the NFL. There is Will's weekly quarterback depth chart. The World Cup is a little over a month away. Germany, Belgium, Spain, Brazil, England. Who are they? Who's the Dallas Cowboys? Who are the Yankees? Who's the Alabama Crimson Tide? Who's the Utah Jazz of the 1990s? Who's the Buffalo Bills of the 1990s? I draw the analogies so you're ready to know the history, the tradition, and the expectations for these world squads. But more importantly, the players in America, the names you'll want to watch, and reasonable expectations for America in this World Cup. I'll make this plea to you. I think soccer is truly the most beautiful game. It has risen in my personal rankings to number 2 behind American football, both pro and college. I truly probably watch as much, if not more, soccer than I do basketball. I love the geometry. I love the passing. I love to see the play build up. What used to look like chaos to me now looks like organization and opportunity. I love players that can see the field and make passes that no one else can see. I love that it resembles some 1980s video game version of Pong when played it just the right way. I love that it starts in the morning and I can drink my coffee while watching English Premier League. I love the history and the tradition of the clubs that date back over a century. And I hope that you will love it as well if you can invest this fall for the first time in the World Cup. So now, if I might have piqued your interest just a bit, stay tuned for this conversation with Fox Sports soccer analyst Alexi Lalas. Alexi Lalas, here we are, the countdown to World Cup 2022. I want to today go through with you in a way that I hope that everyone can understand, even the non-soccer fan, which the World Cup draws in the non-soccer fan. I want to go through the biggest world squads, but we have to start with the USA. And before we get to what you and I think should happen with USA, I want to talk about the squad itself. Is the squad, let's start with the star, Christian Pulisic. Has Christian Pulisic, who I think a year or two ago everyone was going to put in the conversation of maybe one of the best American soccer players ever, along with Landon Donovan and Clint Dempsey, has he lived up to that expectation?
No. First off, he hasn't played in a World Cup. Having said that, I don't think that our expectations of how good he is, and more importantly, how good he can be, have changed. Has he had a rough time over in England playing for Chelsea? Yeah, but that happens to players. I think he may become much more defined through a World Cup and through a successful World Cup. So I don't think that has necessarily changed. When it comes to expectations for this team, this is, you know, as we've talked about before, a very young, inexperienced team. It's going to be the youngest team at the World Cup. You know, with that comes positives and negatives. This incredible youthful swagger that they have had over the cycle into qualifying and now that they're bringing to the cup, I think that that is going to benefit them. But like young kids, they're going to make mistakes. And sometimes when you make mistakes at this level, you can get punished against some very, very good teams that the U.S. is going to come up against.
So a lot of the names on the U.S. squad, and I like how you continue to characterize them as young, and maybe even more than young, inexperienced. A lot of these names, though, have become familiar to the soccer fan who pays attention to the Premier League or maybe even Serie A or whatever it may be, because these guys, Brendan Aaronson, Tyler Adams, Weston McKennie, they're playing in big leagues, often on big clubs, in a way that we really didn't see, at least at this level, this number. American players do so in the past. But it's kind of a mixed bag, though, Alexi, because a lot of them, not the names that I just gave you, not those three in particular, but a lot of them aren't getting playing time, like Pulisic, for that matter. They're on the squads, they're in the leagues, but they're not playing. So I guess that brings up, we have some name recognition, but we're not really getting the experience necessary.
Yeah, I mean, but you need to play as a soccer player wherever you go. You know, having said that, I do think that this introduction that a lot of people, you know, many of your listeners, like you said, aren't necessarily knee deep in the sport, which is fine because that's what a World Cup is there to do. And part of my job and part of our job as a team at Fox is to introduce these players. They are coming through very interesting paths. And one of the things that I think is going to be very evident and I think is going to make a lot of people excited and ultimately very proud is that we have grown up as a soccer nation and we have provided so many more opportunities and pathways, better coaching, better facilities, better connections, and ultimately much more credibility. There's a reason why these players are being sought after and being, you know, acquired from the United States and the wealth of talent that we have. It's because they're good players. To be quite honest, they're also cheaper than other places around the world. And they are going, like you said, to some very big teams, whether it's in the English Premier League, whether it's in the Bundesliga in Germany, whether it's in Serie A in Italy or Spain, all over Europe. And they are populating these teams. Now, the next challenge is, can you be a star on that team? Can you be a consistent player on that team? That has worked out for some of them. Others, not so much. And maybe, you know, you change a team, that sometimes changes. The question will be is, we talk a lot about form in our sport and what that form of that player is. And right, oftentimes it's relative to the club that they are playing at. And if you are not playing, obviously people are going to be a little bit more concerned and pessimistic as to what can happen. But what I've seen is a World Cup can do strange things on and off the field. And the soccer gods can do some strange things. And so just because a player isn't playing or isn't playing well with her club team or his club team doesn't mean that they can't go to a World Cup and star. All things being equal, yes, you want a player playing and you want them playing well.
Form is interesting. You hear that referenced in soccer and basically no other sport. What form is basically what? The how good you're playing right now, your own personal momentum?
Yes, you say somebody is in form when they are playing well, obviously playing like we talked about before, playing, but also playing well. And the theory is that that is going to translate into the national team. It doesn't always work that way. Right. I've seen plenty of times where form is fallacy, and either a player is playing poorly and then goes to the national team, in this case going to a World Cup, for example, and plays really, really well, and you can't wrap your mind around it, but it's a different circumstance, different collection of players around. Or I've seen a player, you know, that's playing really, really well and, you know, sucks it up when they get to the World Cup. So it works both ways.
So I want to go to the viewing experience now for people that in a month or so are going to have a very unique situation, which is we're watching a World Cup in the winter. It's almost always, it's inevitably and invariably in the summer. And this time it's in the winter, in the middle of every league's season, except for MLS, in the middle of every league's season, they take a break for a month for the World Cup. So let's do this through the eyes of the casual viewer. Outside of Pulisic, and sadly, because I'm a soccer fan, I talk to people about soccer, he's not even a household name yet. But outside of Pulisic, who should American soccer fans be watching on this U.S. squad?
Okay, so everybody loves a goalkeeper, right? And we have had some wonderful goalkeepers in the past and goalkeepers that have, you know, really, really played well in World Cups. So Matt Turner is a player who played in Major League Soccer for the New England Revolution. He's just gone over to England, and now he is with Arsenal over there, a very big club. I think he is going to be the starter in goal. And look, every team needs a goalkeeper making saves, and this team in particular, I think they're going to count on Matt Turner. You mentioned Christian Pulisic, who will be the star. going into the World Cup? Who knows coming out of the World Cup? Because, look, I'm talking to you today because of the power of a World Cup. It can change your life forever. Right. So you mentioned Weston McKennie, who I think people are really going to gravitate to in terms of his personality. Tyler Adams, who I think is the calming, quiet, mature, even for a young age type of player in that midfield. Now, who's going to score goals? Jesus Ferreira, I think, is going to be the striker for this team. He plays at FC Dallas in Major League Soccer. And in the back, someone like Walker Zimmerman, who plays for Nashville in Major League Soccer. I think those are just some of the names out there. But, you know, you mentioned people like Brendan Aaronson and others. There will be stars that we're not necessarily talking about right now that will emerge on the stage, either because of just their God-given talent or the soccer gods just smile upon them and the ball goes the right way.
Okay, so I want to ask you about two groups of players, those who could become stars and those who never will be. So first, for those who could become stars, here are two that I like. I want to see what you think. One is Brendan Aaronson. There's something exciting about Brendan Aaronson and when he touches the ball and that something may happen. And the other is Yunus Musa. And I don't know, when I watch him, he plays for Valencia. He's super young, right? It seems like every time he touches the ball, something good's about to happen. An incredible pass, a through ball, or, you know, himself creating a shot on goal. Those two guys are my nominations outside of the obvious one or two who could become stars. What do you think?
So when it comes to Musa, a teenager, and he's only going to get better, and I think we actually saw over the last couple of games that the U.S. played when he was not involved how important he is. You take him out, and the team looks very, very different, and he is a dynamo in that midfield. And I think, you know, I agree with my friend Stu Holden, who's going to be over there broadcasting, in that he is the player, the breakout player, and the player to watch. You mentioned Brendan Aaronson. I think that a lot of people are going to be really excited about this team as a whole, but also the personality and some of the spirit. And when I see Brendan Aaronson out there, there was a time where I didn't know if he was going to be in my starting 11. And he grew on me over the past year, so much so that I'm making a place for him because I want him, because this is a guy that will run through a wall for you.
Right.
And it's not needless running. Okay. He's not just running around with his head cut off or anything like that. But the engine that he has on him, and then the acumen that he has on him from a soccer perspective, by the way, he's playing over in England for Leeds right now. This is a player I think that any coach, any teammate would want to have on the field and want to have. You would want him on your team. And I think that's going to translate to a lot of people, like I said, that are tuning in right now. And look, we want to be moved. We want to believe in this team. We want to be in a time in our country where so little unites us, we want to be united. And that's something that I love about a World Cup. It can bring us together, and all of our different views and everything like that, they can go out the window, at least for that 2 hours, and we can get excited about a U.S. team. And I think that responsibility, I think this team recognizes that responsibility, and more importantly, the opportunity that they have.
So here's the other class of players before we move on to the other squads in the world I want to ask you about, and those that will never be stars. And I don't mean that disparagingly, because these are actually my favorite players, okay? And I have a bit of a personal investment. I come at my soccer conversation with you with humility. I want you to know that. I'm a soccer dad, right? So both of my sons are fully invested in this sport, play at the club level. And what I'm about to say probably reflects the type of player they are. But I like the guys. I think there's a tendency, and I don't know if it's unique to soccer, Alexi, but there's a tendency to say, get the 11 best athletes on the field and find a position. And yet, I see teams that win that actually have players who you're like, why is he on the field? He's not as athletic, but he does things, and oftentimes he does it more times a game than anyone else because he's the guy that touches the ball the most. He plays center back, or he plays central defensive midfield, and he's just the guy that makes the team work. In basketball, these are the glue guys, the grit guys. In soccer, it is Walker Zimmerman. It is Tyler Adams. And to me, it's those guys that will never be up front really taking a shot, never be up front possibly even distributing the assist, but will make the pass that very few people see that is integral to the entire game, the hockey assist, or even the play before the hockey assist. I love those guys, and those are two of those guys that should be stars that never will be in my mind.
Yeah, I mean, look, you've covered and followed sports forever, and you're living it now in terms of your household. A national team is not the best players. It's the best collection of players. And one of the interesting things that's come out over this past cycle, these last 4 years, with all of this talent that we have, is that we're actually having debates and conversations and real animated and heated discussions about who should be on the national team. And when that 11 comes out, when Coach Greg Berhalter comes out each game with an 11, everybody's screaming and yelling, and why isn't this player playing? Why isn't this? That's a good thing. Ultimately, it's Greg Berhalter as the coach, like in any sport. You know, the coach is going to figure out who they feel is best to win. And I guarantee when that first game happens, there will be some choices that Greg Berhalter makes that people will say, oh, I don't know why he did that. But that's a good thing that we have other options out there, because for a long time, we haven't. All of that depth comes with higher expectations for Greg Berhalter. But, you know, to your point, every team has those types of players. And either they just don't get the attention
them.
Oh yeah, and absolutely needs them. Yeah. And either they don't get the attention, or they just don't—they don't seek the attention. But you know as well as I do that though, you know, that's the building block. That is the fundamental of a team. And every team, and it's not—it's not specific to necessarily a position out there. You mentioned a couple of them. And the great thing for me about a World Cup, again, is to be able to introduce as many of these players as possible. Some of them will star in their own right, and some of them will be discovered by what they do on the field and the people that they are and the personalities. And that's also our responsibility to make sure that all these people coming into that soccer tent are welcomed in, that it's inclusive, that we're not doing anything in terms of a barrier to entry. It's a beautiful game. It's a simple game. And as you mentioned, there's a lot of people that come to it during a World Cup, including this unique World Cup in Qatar. We want to make sure that we are there welcoming them in. We're not dumbing down the game, okay? It's a simple game. You'll figure it out, but we're definitely putting our arm around people and saying, hey, this is fun, and for this next 6 weeks, just hang with us and we'll have a good time.
So for the next few minutes here that we have together, I want to go through then introducing the casual viewer to the rest of the world, okay? And I am going to dumb it down so you can reject, and that's what I want. I want you to accept or reject my dumbing down of the world's best squads. And I'm just going to go through the top three or four, okay? But I'm not going to do every one of them. I'm going to bounce around for a moment. But we're going to start at number one. Number one FIFA ranking in the world, Brazil. I look at it, and so when you're watching Brazil, what I would say to the viewers, this is a super team. This is the Miami Heat, although it's not unnaturally collected. They could field a team of guys who won't make the squad that would do very, very well in the World Cup. We're talking about four deep at every single position, the most exciting, talented, athletic, and biggest names in the world. That's Brazil.
Yeah. I'm picking Brazil to win the World Cup. There's a lot of people that are picking Argentina, which I know we'll talk about in a second here. But when it comes to Brazil, it's not only that they have this incredible wealth of talent. It's also that they have this incredible history and an expectation. I mean, it is a dream team type of scenario where it's not even enough to win. It's how you win. And that comes from decades and decades and decades of playing the beautiful game in a way that we have come to expect, where it's flair, it's personality, it's incredible swagger. And, you know, some of the great players, and a guy like Neymar, who a lot of people either know or will be introduced to yet again. Every time he gets the ball, you sit up in your seat a little bit, you hold your breath, because there's the potential for something magical to happen. That's the mark of a star, and they have multiple players like that.
Okay, so ranking number two right now in the world, FIFA, actually features my favorite player in soccer. This is my guy. This is who, when he's playing, I've adopted his professional team years and years ago because I love the way he plays. But it's Belgium, and it's Kevin De Bruyne. And I think, you know, here's what I wrote down for Belgium as a comp for American sports casual fans: Utah Jazz, Buffalo Bills. And what I mean by that is no World Cup, always called the Golden Generation. High expectations, but haven't lived up to it. And De Bruyne is a guy who seems to have four eyes in his head and is a fortune teller, lives 3 seconds ahead of everybody else on the field. What do you think of that characterization of Belgium?
I think it's perfect, actually, because there's undeniable talent and world-class talent. However, we've been saying this now for multiple cycles. And for them, I think the expectation has always been to win a World Cup. And they haven't done that. And so have they failed? Yes, in that that was the expectation. Having said that, they're worth the price of admission. You mentioned De Bruyne and, you know, so many other talented players that they have on that team. This will probably be the last go around where we talk about this golden generation, and it'll start to disperse. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean they can't continue on and won't still have great players, but that generation that we kind of looked at as, you know, the team that could win the World Cup, but you know, they just haven't lived up to it. Having said all of that, this is still a team, like you said, that you should watch because of the individual talent that they have. And it's fun watching a team play under that type of expectation and ultimately under that pressure and that generation looking at it and saying, I have not fulfilled something ultimately when this is over if I don't win the World Cup. That's incredible pressure.
Okay, by the way, when I mentioned Utah Jazz, I should clarify, and Buffalo Bills, I meant the 1990s versions of those teams. Always in it, always in the finals, but not getting over the hump. All right, interestingly, I'm going to put these two teams to you at the same time. I was going to skip Argentina. There's something boring about Argentina to me right now. It's like, okay, Messi's been here forever, and there's a few other names, and there's some young guys now as well, like Julian Alvarez or whatever. But I was going straight to France, and my comp for France at number four, Argentina's number three, is Ohio State or Alabama in college football. They just restock, man. Over and over with France, it's like they've got a whole new stock of young guys stepping in to always remain, you know, right there among the top, you know, whatever it is, 2 to 4 teams in the world.
So, okay, so first I'll take Argentina. This is the most balanced Argentina team that we have seen, and therefore I think that's where some of the boredom comes that you're talking about, in that there's, mm-hmm. there's no drama. They are well coached. They have finally checked the box of winning a major tournament, winning Copa America. And so for Messi, you know, look, Messi is going to go down as one of the greats, and for many people, arguably the greatest player ever to play the game. But when you are diminutive, left-footed, attacking player for Argentina, you are always going to be measured relative to Diego Maradona. And Diego Maradona won a World Cup. And so that type of pressure will continue on. However, I do think that Argentina is going in here, as I said, with a lot less problems than they've had in the past. They revere Messi in terms of his teammates, but they don't defer to him all the time and just say, hey, here's the ball, go dribble through people and do your stuff. He can still do that, but that's where that balance comes from. When it comes to France, keep in mind that it's very, very difficult and very, very rare for teams to win back-to-back World Cups. They were incredible 4 years ago in the World Cup. To your point, they have restocked. France, though, behind the scenes, you never know when they're going to implode. And don't put it past the French with the drama that they often have to have problems when it comes to the camp and the setup there that can trickle into what happens on the field. But, you know, a guy like Kylian Mbappe for France, still so young, already a World Cup winner, playing at PSG, and who knows where he's going to go continuing on. Another guy that's worth the price of admission when it comes to stars.
One more World Cup squad. Here's your comp. It's England and it's the Dallas Cowboys. It is such high expectations, falling so far below those expectations, and just stars across the board. I mean, I can't come up with a reason why England always falls short. On paper, you look at it and you're like, I mean, I don't know. I mean, there are squads that are better, like Brazil on paper, but not many as good as England.
Yeah, I mean, there is an incredible arrogance that exists when it comes to England and the way they see themselves, and certainly the way that they see the game, and when it comes to their national team. This is a very good England team, don't get me wrong. They have weaknesses, they are beatable, and from a U.S. perspective, obviously being in our group, that's a good thing. But on the day, England could kick our ass when it comes to the U.S. So we're going to have a very, very good performance against this England team. But ultimately, we're going to be underdogs, which is a wonderful, comfortable position for the U.S. to be in against England. England, the expectation is, given the generation that they have, given the success that they have, and just given the history and the way they feel about themselves, anything less than a World Cup is not going to be acceptable. And so that's the pressure that they are on. And fine, they can have all of that pressure. But, you know, to your point, people still tune in. It's the same with the Dallas Cowboys, right? Win or lose, people will tune in. People will hate watch. People will, as many people hate them as love them. And that's the mark of a big, big, super type of team. And they are. And, you know, all of the money and all of the names and all of that pressure, when that whistle blows, that's not going to play for you.
Okay, cognizant of your time, before we get to the U.S. expectations, I just want to ask you this. Two squads that I think are not, well, they're still in the top 10, but they don't get the conversation that those that we just mentioned, that I do like when I see them on paper and in performance in the past. Your thoughts on Netherlands and Portugal. I actually think they both look really good, especially Portugal on paper.
Yeah, and you know, Portugal, obviously so much focus and attention is around Cristiano Ronaldo. And look, this World Cup will be possibly the last time we see Cristiano Ronaldo and Messi play for their teams, and that's reason enough to tune in. But when it comes to the Portugal team, I think they're not sneaky good because people have seen them grow, and it's not just about Cristiano Ronaldo. Part of the question right now is, are they adapting to him? And do they have to adapt to him? And how important is he ultimately? So I'm right there with you when it comes to Portugal. And, you know, it's Portugal. They have a wonderful pedigree. The Netherlands, a lot of people are looking at them. And, you know, I look at them and maybe Denmark as, they're not dark horses. I mean, it's the Netherlands. So it's still a very, very good team. But they're not in that upper echelon type of place when it comes to teams right now. And they're in a very easy group. Keep in mind that if the U.S. were to come out of their group, it's a real good possibility that they end up playing the Netherlands, which is in Group A over there with the hosts Qatar and Senegal and Ecuador. And I think that the Netherlands will win that group. So if they end up being the first from that group and the U.S. ends up being, let's say, second, then there's a good chance that we'll meet the Netherlands in the round of 16.
Okay, U.S. expectations. So for the viewer, we're in a group stage to begin, which is four teams. For the U.S., that's England, Wales, the U.S., and Iran. Two teams emerge from the group stage and make the bracket tournament. For the U.S., in order to advance, that means they're going to have to probably beat out Wales, Alexi, which is, by the way, a good squad. So that's no given. I can't imagine England doesn't make it out of the group stage. So what is a fair expectation for the American fan of the U.S.? I certainly expect coming out of the group stage. That's a tough first-round matchup in the knockout stage, as you just mentioned. But I think my expectations for the U.S. are not unfairly high.
No. I mean, first off, we've gotten out of the group before, okay? I mean, just getting back to the World Cup, we don't want to, you know, break our arms patting ourselves on the back. We've been to plenty of the World Cups. That's why it was so devastating not to be at the last one, considering how consistently we have been at World Cups. So you've gotten back to the World Cup. That's fine. Now you have to get out of the group. By the way, we've gotten out of previous groups. So your expectation, my expectation, our expectation, you're damn right we should get out of the group, especially this group. So conventional wisdom says England's the best team in the group, right? But when it comes to Iran and Wales, these are teams that this U.S. team, albeit young and inexperienced, these are teams that the U.S. should beat. The way that it sets up in terms of order actually benefits the U.S., as I mentioned. You come out of the chute, and if you get that win against Wales, that's 3 points. Your next game is against England. The pressure is off now. Whatever happens against England happens. And, you know, it's all kind of gravy against England. And then that third game against Iran, both teams that you should beat. Here's the kicker, though. Iran and Wales are looking at the U.S. in the same way and each other in the same way. So those three teams, Iran, United States, and Wales, all look at each other as beatable opponents. And then England is kind of there, and you take your chances, and anything happens. The problem will be is if in that first game, and I don't want to put all the eggs in the basket, but the reality is if on that Monday, the second day of the tournament when the U.S. faces Wales, if they don't get a result against Wales, that could be problematic because your second game, as we mentioned, is England. And you do not want to come into that England game desperate for some points.
So it could be over in one game, all of this fun. Okay, so I'm super excited. I think a lot of people, I think the world will be tuned in. It's going to be fun. By the way, most of the games are in the morning or before, you know, early afternoon, 8 a.m., 10 a.m., 1 in the afternoon. It's a great way to wake up watching the World Cup. The only bummer is possibly the best player in the world isn't in the World Cup right now, or at least the hottest player in the world is not in the World Cup, right? That's fair, Alexi. Erling Haaland, Norway, not in the World Cup.
He's incredible. He is incredible. And, but, you know, it's a representation of your country, and, you know, it's where you were born and ultimately who you are representing. And, you know, just to bring it all back around, I do think that it is the responsibility and, like I said, the opportunity of this team to make us proud and to make us excited and to, like I said, unite us. And I love the fact that you know so much about soccer, but I also love the fact of the way that you talk about it because we need to be more welcoming. We need to embrace all of the, not just the soccer fans, but the potential soccer fans that are there. And all of the people, if you're listening right now, yeah, I mean, you I think you're going to be excited about the World Cup and what you see on the field. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, if you don't know anything about the game, it's okay. All right. You're going to be just fine. You know, I'm going to hold your hand. It's going to be just fine.
Well, you know what? I will tell you, and I'm going to let you go with this, but I used to make fun of soccer. I did. I was like, a game that can end in a 0-0 tie is no game for me. It is now my second favorite sport to American football. I like it even better than basketball, which is I love. And what I realized is it's not chaos. As I've watched more and more and gotten to know the personalities, which is key, and then I love the history of the clubs, I also know what's attempting to be done, and I love it. I love watching the geometry. I love watching the passes in the back, to be honest, to see what we're setting up. And it's not just chaos and happenstance. It's actually a concerted, you know, strategic game of Pong. It looks like Pong, you know, the video game. And if it's been played well, it's mesmerizing. I love it.
It's also a player's game. There's no timeouts. I mean, the reality is, from a coaching perspective, your job is during the week. And then the whistle blows. And I always loved that about the game, is that it's up to me what happens. I get to decide. And yes, there's strategy, and yes, you rehearse some different things, but there's no timeouts, there's no plays getting run in or anything like that. I know there's set pieces and all that, but relative to other sports, it is a player's game, and that's a wonderful thing to see.
Can't wait to watch your call, Alexi. Can't wait to watch the World Cup in just about a month. Thank you so much, man.
Thank you for having me.
There you go. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Alexi Lalas. Share that with your friends as they get ready for the World Cup a little over a month away. Leave us a rating wherever you listen to your audio entertainment. Leave a comment on YouTube. I will always read your comments. And check me out again on Friday. I'll see you again next time.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
Hey there, it's me, Kennedy. Make sure to check out my podcast, Kennedy Saves the World. It is 5 days a week, every week. Download and listen at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.